Hey, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. The Daily Caller Podcast for Friday, June 21st, 2019. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. There's a lot of stuff to get to, so much to talk about. I appreciate the heck out of those of you who have given the show ratings and reviews, particularly on iTunes, although I read them everywhere. I even read the comments on Ricochet when people post them there. So keep that going. And always, most of you just email me, Derek@dailycaller.com, which is fine. It's all well and good. I have a couple of other email addresses that I get emails and entries for the contests and all of that. But if you could please restrict it to Derek@dailycaller.com, it helps me organize all of them, particularly the book entries, because when I have to go and hunt for somebody's email address who won, I don't know which inbox to look in. I don't know where you came in. I just assume and hope that it's all in the Daily Caller email. It just makes my life administratively easier, if you don't mind. But you can email me however you want. And like I said, if you want to win a signed copy of Shannon Bream's book, Finding the Bright Side, just send me an email and let me know you want to be in. We'll draw next week on that. I think we're going to do the interview next week. Hopefully we're going to do the interview next week on Wednesday. So have them in by then. Like I said, lots of stuff to get to and not a lot of time to do it. The last half of the show, last 25 minutes of the program is going to be an interview with Liz Harrington. She is the new spokeswoman she's the national spokeswoman. She's the big one in charge. She's the one you see all over the television machine for the Republican National Committee. So that I found to be very interesting. And we're hoping to have her back on the show with some regularity. And like I said, we'll be reaching out to the Democrats as well to see if we can get some of them to come on. But it's always nice to get information from the insiders, the people who are doing the job. See if we can't get them to slip up at some point and give us some juicy stuff that they don't want us to have. All right, let's get to the news, shall we? Because we are pressed for time. Last night, I'm sitting around, I'm looking at the Twitter machine, I'm watching the television machine, and all these machines are going off at once. Big breaking news. The New York Times has itself a story. Holy Frank Tanana, what is going on? Kind of sitting on the edge of our seats, expecting some kind of military strike against Iran. Iran has attacked a Japanese tanker in the Straits of Hormuz, and they shot down a U.S. drone in international waters yesterday. Before we get into the New York Times story, I just want to say that it's kind of interesting. Democrats in the media, ever since the attack on the tanker, have been questioning whether or not Iran actually did this. Many liberals have been floating the idea that this was a staged event by the United States to try and get public sentiment behind the idea of a war with Iran. It's a Gulf of Tonkin type of incident, they say. Well, the intelligence community, the United States intelligence community, are the people who are telling us that Iran was behind the attack on the Japanese tanker. Wasn't it just, not that long ago, a couple of weeks ago, even up until a couple of weeks ago, and certainly for a couple of years, that we were told by these very same liberals that questioning our intelligence community is a threat to our democracy and un-American and an outrage, and how dare Donald Trump do it when it comes to the Obama administration spying on the Trump campaign? That whole thing, the way it evolved, there was no spying, I don't know what you wiretap, that's insane, Donald Trump is nuts, to, well, they had to do it because there was all this evidence that Donald Trump was a Russian plotter. There were so many things that were going on that were suspicious that our government had to look into. That story has evolved considerably, so it makes sense that it would evolve even further from you can't possibly question the integrity of our intelligence community to, hey, you know, is the intelligence community lying? Is the intelligence community in on this, trying to start a war with Iran? Just kind of an interesting aside there, and it's weird how that works. And, of course, none of these people make any connection in their own brains to, hey, just last week we were saying that the intelligence community being questioned by the president is an outrage. Now they're saying we should question the intelligence community. Very difficult. Very, very funny. Very hypocritical. That being said, it strikes me as odd that so many people, liberals and supposed conservatives, are upset at the prospect, terrified at the prospect of a strike against Iran. There's no question that Iran shot down our drone. They've admitted it. They're quite proud of it. The question is, what do we do about it? Now, there probably will be some kind of response eventually. What form that manifests in remains to be seen. But we can't just allow a hostile nation, the world's number one sponsor of terrorism, to get away with that without some kind of response. But to hear people talk about it, they think that, well, you know, a war with Iran, that would be, first of all, there's nobody talking about a war. It's retaliation is a different thing than war. They shoot down something of ours, we blow up something of theirs. It happens quite often in recent history. But then I started thinking about the prospect of a war with Iran, and what is it that unites people like Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with someone like Tucker Carlson, who did a big monologue last night about the military-industrial complex and how this is all just a whole bunch of people who want to profit off of war. There has to be something other than those options out there. I think AOC and Ilhan Omar are horrified at the prospect of people living under the iron boot of Islamofascism actually being free. That scares the hell out of them. I think they're more sympathetic to every totalitarian regime in the country than or in the planet than they are capable of understanding. They just automatically knee-jerk side with anybody who is on the opposite side of the United States. That's the nature of the progressives. Tucker's take was a little bit more nuanced, but equally as wrong, in my opinion. He thinks that there is this industrial complex that just wants war because they want to hammer giant checks. I have no doubt there are some people like that, but that is not why decisions are made in this country. And he always cites the Iraq War as an example. The Iraq War was a mistake. The Iraq War was a mistake. The Iraq War, while predicated upon false intelligence, false, not fraudulent. There's a huge difference, and you know what that is. False intelligence that the entire world believed, and Saddam Hussein did the best to make the world believe it, was a failure because we stayed. And that's the real problem over there. It's the same problem in Afghanistan. At some point, it's not to say that those countries did not have it coming, particularly Afghanistan, for harboring Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. But at some point, we just have to say, okay, we have defeated our enemy. We're moving on. The problem is the politicians in Washington realize and fear the other side saying, you've abandoned this and it's a failed state because you left. It's true, politically, they would do that, but it shouldn't matter. They always had that big saying, you know, politics stops at the water's edge. Politics should stop at the water's edge. Once we killed as many al-Qaeda members as we possibly could, we should have gotten the hell out of there. If the Afghan people want to fall back into the realm of tribalism and despot national governments that oppress them and try and wipe out anything remotely related to the past or anything un-Islamic, that's on them. We can only give people the opportunity to be free. We can't force them to be free. That's sort of the opposite of freedom. And we have to be honest with ourselves that there are certain parts of the world where tribalism rules everything, where the history of these regions and the people who live in those regions is not particularly conducive to freedom. Freedom is not something people can have thrust upon them. It is something they have to come to on their own. Freedom in this country was not thrust upon us. We fought for it. We wanted it. We had leaders who made the case and won the argument. Over in the Middle East, there is no such movement, or it's so small as to not really register on the radar. It's a matter of, from a foreign policy perspective, which despot do you want? Do you want this despot or that despot? Well, which one is going to be better for our interests? Nobody really over there is making the case for individual liberty. Nobody. They're all varying degrees of some form of Islamic-based government. And that's fine. That's their lives. They're going to have to, if they want freedom, and I don't know that they do. They want the concept of freedom, but not in an understandable way that we understand it. They just want their governments not to kill them, which doesn't seem like that much to ask, but that's what you get with totalitarian regimes. So we've spent the last 15 years in Afghanistan in the hope that somehow, eventually, some part of the brain of the Afghan people will flick on and they'll say, hey, wait a second, men and women are equal and people can get along if they're in different tribes and that shouldn't matter and everybody should learn how to read and so on and so forth and all the things that we take for granted, and we really do take them for granted. It just doesn't click because it's not a switch. It's something they have to come to internally. There has to be some kind of leader or group of leaders over there who are going to really make the case forcefully, not just to their fellow elites, but to the people, that this is an important concept that they should embrace. That hasn't happened because they're still mired down in centuries-old petty tribalism. You're never going to overcome that externally. You're never going to, you can force people, Saddam Hussein did it, you can force people under an iron boot of a national government to stop killing each other, because if they even try, you'll wipe out 1,000 of them without thinking about it. But the second Saddam Hussein was gone, look at what happened in Iraq. The old tribalism came right back. It was always there. It was always festering under the surface. And the second they got their chance, they didn't go, we're free. They go, oh, thank God we got rid of that despot. Now we can go kill those SOBs in that other tribe. Let's go get them, boys. So the idea of a war with Iran really terrifies a lot of people. And I don't fear a war with Iran in the traditional sense. We could kick the living crap out of Iran's military, no questions asked, if the politicians in this country would let us do it, let the military do it. My fear is that if we did go to war with Iran, that we would be there forever, because we are everywhere forever, because we're hell-bent on this idea that people everywhere want to be free, that people will embrace freedom if given the opportunity, and that doesn't happen. So with all that in mind, and everybody wondering, what are we going to do about shooting down the drone? And we absolutely should retaliate. The New York Times had a story last night. The headline, Trump approves strikes on Iran, then abruptly pulls back. Huh. Took four reporters to put this thing together. President Trump approved military strikes against Iran in retaliation for downing an American surveillance drone, but pulled back from launching them on Thursday night after a day of escalating tensions. As late as 7 p.m., military and diplomatic officials were expecting a strike after intense discussion and debate at the White House among the president's top national security officials and congressional leaders, according to multiple senior administration officials involved in or briefed on the deliberations. They say that the planes were allegedly in the air. Now, this official said the president had initially approved attacks on a handful of Iranian targets like radar and missile batteries. The operation was underway in its early stages when it was called off. A senior administration official said planes were in the air and ships were in position, but no missiles had been fired when word came to stand down, the official said. First of all, aside from the bad reporting of having one anonymous source instead of two or one person on the record, this strikes me as no big deal. This actually makes me think that this is a message to Iran that, okay, we're going to do this. We could do this at any time, and we're serious about this. The president ordered it and then changed his mind. He could easily order it again. This is message sending. I don't think this is backing down. I think this is escalating up the message, the talk, the diplomacy, because we don't have direct diplomatic ties with Iran. So that's how I see it. But this was, of course, spun as another feckless president can't make up his mind. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing. No, the president isn't particularly fond of war. He campaigned on getting us out of endless wars like the type I described. He doesn't really want to go haphazardly into another one with Iran. So this could be the last gasp chance for Iran to step up to the plate and change their tone. Maybe pick up the phone. Who the hell knows? If you let somebody know that you're this close to getting shot at, and we can get back to that point pretty damn quickly, maybe you can impact their decision-making, their actions. Personally, I doubt it. The Iranian mullahs know, and the Ayatollah know, that they're not going to be the ones that are targeted. So a missile battery here and a radar station there is a small price to pay for flexing their muscle in the region and standing up to the big bully that is the United States. I think they anticipated a retaliation. I know they anticipated a retaliation. I think they probably anticipated a bigger retaliation than that. But as long as it doesn't impact them, what the hell do they care? Their people are expendable to them. They're props. When they die, they hold massive rallies and chant death to America, forgetting the fact that, you know, they had it coming. So I don't see how this is such a big deal, although it will be made a big deal of throughout the day today. I guarantee it. Liberals will be outraged, saying the president has to come to Congress to get permission to do anything towards Iran, which is false. It's not true. It has the War Powers Act. Congress should probably read it. They passed it. Gives the president the ability to act and then has 30 or 45 days, whatever it is, before he then has to go to Congress to seek permission or withdraw the military. So that box is checked. By the way, there was no such outrage from the left when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama decided to bomb Libya. Just remember that. There was no, we need permission for that. There was from conservatives, but not from these Democrats. And I will say, Libya is actually a pretty damn good example. Not what Barack Obama did, but what Ronald Reagan did. Libya had bombed Pan Am Flight 103, I think it was. It was a Pan Am flight, I know, over Lockerbie, Scotland. They also bombed a bar in Germany and killed a couple of U.S. military people in West Germany. Muammar Gaddafi was behind that. President Reagan retaliated. He didn't go after a couple of military installations. He tried to kill Muammar Gaddafi. That was about the last we'd heard of Muammar Gaddafi for about 15 years until under George W. Bush, he said, here's my weapons of mass destruction program. Please don't bomb me again. So that's the difference between sending a message and really sending a message. We really sent a message to Muammar Gaddafi by literally trying to kill him. Missing, but trying. We bombed his house. I think we killed a family member. So I don't think the mullahs are really going to care all that much if you kill or blow up a radar or a missile battery someplace. But we have to do something. So it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out. In other news, I didn't want to spend that much time on this, but the history lesson I think is kind of important. In other news, the problems for Joe Biden, boy howdy, it just keeps getting worse. The Democrats in the field are still coming after him. They're sensing, sniffing a little blood in the water. They really don't have much else to run on. So this is really all they've got And when they see their opening, they're going to take it. Along that vein, Bernie Sanders was on MSNBC with the dumbest person in cable news. You know, Chris Cuomo and Don Lemon get all the attention when it comes to the dumb Olympics and cable news. And they should. They really are the Laurel and Hardy or the Abbott and Costello of stupidity. Maybe even the Martin and Lewis. They hand it off to one another. The two of them together are a special kind of stupid. But Stephanie Ruhle is really the silent champion of this whole thing, to be perfectly honest with you. She's just incredibly, incredibly obtuse. She got into an argument, and this is, of course, she's a journalist. She's a straight news journalist, according to the network. She had on Bernie Sanders, and you can tell that she's a fan of Joe Biden. She loves herself some Joe Biden. In this exchange, listen to Stephanie Ruhle go to bat for sniffy Uncle Joe, man. She just goes to bat for him. And Bernie Sanders smacks her down and says, no, you can have, that's your opinion. I think president or the vice president should apologize for what he said. There's no point in discussing the merits of that. But this exchange is very telling about where MSNBC is. You notice 4 years ago, well, not 4 years ago, in 2016, boy howdy, they love themselves some Bernie Sanders. But now pretty much everybody's Bernie Sanders. They don't have to love Bernie Sanders anymore. They don't have to love an old white guy when they have all different configurations of people who are saying the exact same thing. So they kind of throw Bernie Sanders under the bus. But except for Stephanie Ruhle, who loves herself some Joe Biden. Listen to this exchange.
Senator, you have joined Cory Booker in the last 24 hours, calling on Joe Biden to apologize for comments he made about working with segregationists. And it's the more people hear about it, some are saying, well, he was applauding or celebrating that. That wasn't what Joe Biden was doing. Joe Biden was trying to make the point that bipartisanship is necessary. He's done so working with the deplorable of the deplorables. That's why he gave the example of the segregationists. So why is it that you believe he has to apologize?
Look, I mean, I think the media makes a bigger deal of it than it is.
So he doesn't have
all
to
that
apologize?
I said, no. Yeah, I do. I do. Because it's one thing. Look, when you're in Congress, you work with everybody. I do. I think every member of the Senate, every member of the House works. People who have very, very different points of view. But I don't think you have to be touting personal relations with people who were very brutal segregationists.
But, Senator,
he wasn't touting relations.
That's my view on it. His point was...
Okay, ma'am, I'm sorry. If you disagree with me, that's fine. That's my view.
You got to bless her heart, as people in the South say about Stephanie Ruhle. She's trying, man. She's trying. Joe Biden, before we get into the problems in the Biden campaign, I want to play one little isolation of what Stephanie Ruhle said that illustrates just how dumb she is. She's in her 40s. She should know better. I think she's in her 40s. She looks it. She should know better. But again, it's another example, and maybe it's just common over at MSNBC that these morons don't know the party of the people they're talking about. But the segregationists, the evil segregationists that Joe Biden was talking about, how he was cordial with and he was able to get along and work with and do those things, they were Democrats. All the segregationists were Democrats. The party of Jim Crow, the party of slavery, the party of segregation was the Democrats. But Stephanie Ruhle says he was just trying to illustrate how he's able to work in a bipartisan way.
That wasn't what Joe Biden was doing. Joe Biden was trying to make the point that bipartisanship is necessary.
It is entirely possible that Stephanie Ruhle doesn't understand what the word bipartisanship means. She maybe thinks that it's Democrats working with Democrats. And in fact, on MSNBC, that might be as bipartisan as they're willing to get. But that, of course, is not the definition of bipartisan in any way, shape, or form. But you've got to love the way that they're scrambling to try and protect Joe. He wasn't saying that. He would never say anything nice about those people. He's Joe Biden. He's just Joe being Joe. Well, Washington Post has a story. Tensions ripple through Biden's Biden campaign as his past working relationships with a segregationist senator comes to the forefront. It's weird how, after two previous runs for the presidency and two terms as vice president, suddenly journalists have decided to do a little bit of journalism when it comes to sniffy Uncle Joe, isn't it? Where was all this stuff and these reporters before? But now that Joe Biden is up against people who are much younger, much more progressive, more diverse, suddenly he becomes expendable. They can't hurt Barack Obama by attacking Joe, so they're perfectly fine with doing it now. The story, it's just interesting here what he wrote. I'll read the first two paragraphs. Joe Biden was a freshman senator, the youngest member of the august body, when he reached out to an older colleague for help on one of his early legislative proposals. The courts were ordering racially segregated school districts to bus children to create more integrated classrooms, a practice Biden opposed and wanted to change. Now, why didn't we hear about this in 2008, in 2012? Part of this is the fault of the Republicans not bringing this up, but most of it is Democrats not doing their reporting. He wrote, this is Joe Biden, what he wrote to a segregationist Senator James O. Eastland. Quote, and this is one of the senators, by the way, that Joe Biden sort of said, hey, I was able to get along with a cordial relationship with these horrible people, except he didn't call them horrible people. Quote, I want you to know that I very much appreciate your help during this week's committee meeting in attempting to bring my anti-busing legislation to a vote. End quote. Joe Biden wrote that on June 30th, 1977. Joe Biden wrote that. He's trying to stop integration in Delaware through busing. No, we don't want that. We don't want black kids going to school with white kids. Yet he is a civil rights hero who's worked on civil rights his whole life, he said yesterday. And Stephanie Ruhle is saying he wasn't saying nice things about them. He was just trying to say how he worked in a bipartisan way with members of his own party. These people, it's fun watching them. This is a bit of a, it's not a civil war, at least not yet in the Democratic Party, but it certainly is a lot of skirmishes going on there that could easily blow up into something if something doesn't break soon. Joe Biden, for his part, has refused to apologize, and I kind of admire him for that. He just doesn't seem to realize what the Democratic Party is, what it has become, which is kind of ironic, if you ask me, because he was involved with, he was the running mate of and the vice president of the guy who helped usher it in more than just about anybody else, Barack Obama and the new wokeness. The party changed dramatically under the Obama-Biden administration, and apparently the Biden part of that administration didn't notice anything that was going on. It's to the point now, Cory Booker, who is finally getting some press, he's got to be very excited. He's getting some actual press by attacking Joe Biden, appeared on the Lawrence O'Donnell show on MSNBC yesterday, and he was asked whether or not he could be Biden's vice president. This isn't about Biden. This is about the Democratic Party now. I'm shifting gears a little bit because what the Democratic Party has become is illustrated by Cory Booker here. Listen to what he says and remember a time when choosing a running mate was based upon who, or at least the argument was publicly, it was always realistically trying to carry a state that the person was from. But it used to be predicated upon you need to pick somebody who could become president should something awful happen. That means you want to choose the best qualified person you can find. That's no longer the case in the Democratic Party. They have a new criteria as laid out by Cory Booker right here.
Could you run on a ticket with Joe Biden?
I do not think there should be two men on a ticket.
Okay, that's
I do not think there should be two men on a ticket.
Let me ask this.
I think given the field we have, yeah, extraordinary people,
okay,
we should have tickets that have racial and gender diversity in them. Come on, we're a party that should talk to who we are as a nation. We're a nation with extraordinary.
I think you're going to get a lot of Democratic delegates who agree with you on that.
Yes.
You got to love that. No. You got to have Racial and gender diversity. I don't mean to break this to Cory Booker, but apparently I am breaking it to Cory Booker. He's black. That would bring racial diversity to a Biden ticket. But apparently you're only allowed to pick a... If you're a white guy, you have to pick a non-white woman in Cory Booker's world. Forget the best qualified. Forget who can best help the ticket. It is which boxes do you check in the intersectionality Olympics? And then there you just go with that. And Lawrence O'Donnell's like, yeah, a lot of Democrats are going to like that. You got to love these people. They have lowered the bar to say, it doesn't matter. It's all about what you look like, not who you are. Not who you are, what you believe, or anything like that. That leads us to this story from Politico magazine. The headline, Hollywood's top gay donors have mixed feelings about Buttigieg. What? Hollywood's top gay donors? This is how far down the left drills in intersectionalism to find the most irrelevant thing about somebody and say, well, this is all you are. This is who you are. It doesn't matter. Before he paused the campaign activities to remain in South Bend, Indiana, reeling from an officer-involved shooting of the death of a 53-year-old black man, Buttigieg was scheduled to trek to Los Angeles for a fundraising swing, including an event at the Beverly Hills home of mega producer Ryan Murphy that's co-hosted by a long list of high-profile LGBTQ Hollywood figures. According to one fundraising source, the event, with tickets starting at $1,500 per person, sold out months ago and was likely to bring in at least $250,000. It begins. It's being postponed. There's a reason this group is so eager to meet Mayor Pete. For many of these influential donors, this will be their first ever chance to contribute to a viable gay presidential candidate, something that would have been hard to fathom just over a decade ago, when their choices were a field of top prospects who opposed same-sex marriage, or just over a generation ago when Democratic campaign viewed LGBTQ money as too risky to take. By the way, a decade ago, it was Barack Obama and Joe Biden who were opposed to same-sex marriage. It wasn't until the 2012 re-election bid, when they weren't raising as much money as they'd hoped from gay Hollywood, that they suddenly changed their tune. Their deeply held beliefs just 4 years prior suddenly weren't so deeply or held anymore. But I love the mentality, because throughout this article, they talk about, well, some of these Hollywood gays aren't giving to Pete Buttigieg. Don't worry, they're giving to other Democrats. They're very clear about that. It's Hollywood. They're all leftists. But why would somebody donate to a Joe Biden or a Bernie Sanders if you're gay when you've got Mayor Pete over there? They don't seem, in Politico magazine, in the media in general, on the left in particular, they don't seem to fathom the idea, the concept, that somebody could like a candidate for other reasons other than A, they have matching skin tone, or B, sexuality or gender. That is beyond the pale. They can't grasp that. This is the modern Democratic Party. It is bizarre to watch people, adults, act like this. You kind of expect this from children in schools. They always form all these cliques and everything. But no, this is the modern Democratic Party. Sick people who judge people. They say, oh, you know, we can't judge anybody on anything. That's all you do is judge. And anybody who strays from that norm is fair game for destruction. When Politico tweeted this out, this is how they tweeted it. Quote, analysis, Hollywood's gay donors are giving money to Buttigieg, but not exclusively. Like, oh my God, who are they? Is there some sort of term for gay Uncle Toms? Because that's essentially what they're doing. It's really rather disturbing and shocking. Not really all that surprising, but it is disgusting. Finally today, as you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders is leaving the White House, And some reporters in the White House press corps decided to throw a little happy hour for her just to say goodbye. You work with somebody, you do these kind of things if you're a decent human being. Unfortunately, in the White House press corps, there aren't that many decent human beings. So somebody leaked the email invite to the Huffington Post, who was all too happy to report it. They didn't say where it was, but you can figure out where it's going to be. So now the woke left is on high alert that next week there's going to be, unless they cancel it, which they'll probably be forced to cancel it, an event with a bunch of journalists and Sarah Huckabee Sanders. So the little fascists will be able to show up and disrupt, shout at people, chant, do whatever the hell it is they do. Just existing in their proximity is offensive enough and cause enough for people to leave because of the body odor. But this is journalism in 2019, ladies and gentlemen. It is dead. It is long since dead. All right, that is all the time we have for today. The interview is coming up right after I finish talking here. It's with Liz Harrington, who is the RNC spokeswoman. It's pretty good. Hope to have her back in studio sometime soon. You can email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. Please don't forget to share this around with your friends on social media and in real life, non-media, human media. And have a great weekend. It's my birthday weekend. So have a good birthday weekend for me. That will be my gift, if you don't mind. And be back here on, you know what? My gift is get more people to sign up and subscribe. And have a good weekend. Two gifts. You don't even have to wrap either one of them. And be back here on Monday for another exciting episode. Have a great weekend. Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Caller podcast, the Friday video edition, or the second half of the Friday audio show, depending on how we get into your head. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. Thank you very much for tuning in, pushing play, telling a friend, and all that good stuff. Don't forget to subscribe. Joining us this week, it's a big week in politics. The president just announced his reelection bid, so we went out and got the best we could afford, which is nothing, but she's pretty damn good anyway. It's Liz Harrington. She is the RNC's national spokeswoman. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the president announced this week, and then a Brinks trucks just kept showing up at Trump reelection headquarters. $25 million almost in 24 hours.
Yeah, less than 24 hours, actually. It was $24.8 million. So that's more than $1 million per hour. It was an incredible haul. It's also more than the top five polling Democrats combined. And it's more than most of these candidates have raised an entire quarter. So it's, we were pretty
Poor
happy
Beto.
About that. Right.
The shine is gone. Before we get your assessment of just some of the general sense of the Democratic field, let's talk about the president's field. In his speech this week, since we're recording this on Wednesday, and the speech happened last night, but we're airing it on Friday, I thought there was a very powerful moment in the president's speech. It was about a minute long where he went off on Democrats. It was kind of a standard stump speech up until this moment where he said that the Democrats basically don't have any respect for the Constitution. They want to secure borders around the world, but not in this country. They talk about a loyalty to free speech, but then do everything to silence people. And a vote for any Democrat is a vote for socialism and essentially ending the American dream. Does that resonate? I think it would resonate. Would that resonate with the American people? Because I think that should be picked up by candidates no matter what they're running for.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's such a good contrast going on right now. We've got a great economy. Mm. Jobs are coming back. I mean, the president, when he announced 4 years ago, he said, I'd be the jobs president. Here we have 6 million jobs. We can call him the jobs president now. Mm-hmm. Wages going up, record low unemployment almost across every demographic. And then you contrast that to what the Democrats are saying. And I love the media coverage because the New York Times, what did we learn from this relaunch? Oh, it was just a rally. First of all, it's so dismissive, right? Yeah, it was a rally. It was a pretty big one. I was there. It
Joe
was pretty
Biden
incredible.
Had, you know, his exploratory committee. Then he launched in Pittsburgh. Then he officially launched in Philadelphia. Every single time, there was not a single reporter going, oh, this old game.
Right. And there was also, like, no one there at any of those events compared to this. But their second takeaway was, back to the hello, darkness, my old friend, is what they said. And I was there Actually, it was a very uplifting. We were talking about all the great things that are happening in the country. And the darkest part of the speech was exactly that. We were talking about what the Democrats want to take this country and what direction they want to take us in, which is far to the left. And bringing up policies, failed socialist policies throughout the 20th century. That's what they're calling for. That's what the Green New Deal is. It's a complete economic transformation of the United States and an overhaul of capitalism, getting rid of it, getting rid of private health insurance. I mean, the entire thing, what they're calling for is dark and dreary, actually, if you know anything about history.
Well, Democrats are pro-choice on only one area. Don't talk about education choice, healthcare choice, nothing. Just abortion, nothing else.
Right.
So when you look at the polls, you're right. The economy is booming. We've been told that we'll never see 3% growth again, that 1% to 2% was the new normal in the Obama administration. Manufacturing jobs were never coming back. It's just not going to happen. And all of that has proven to be untrue.
And then Trump, Joe Biden's trying to take credit for it somehow. It's amazing.
But still, the president in polling, and I realize we're a year and a half before anybody votes, still it has people freaked out. I don't think they should be. But what do you say to people who look at this and you say, you're losing to Bernie Sanders by 9 points?
It's not going to happen. That's insane. Because that's a ridiculous poll. And they were wrong. They're totally meaningless at this stage. And especially the national polls, they just... the metrics that they're doing, it makes no sense. It does not, it's not accurate at all. It's something that the media can talk about because they don't want to talk about like the good news that's actually coming out in this country every day. And so they fall back on these polls, but they've never been able to poll this president accurately. They never saw him coming in 2016. All of the polls showed him losing to Hillary Clinton. And it's just not, it's just totally worthless because we don't have a Democratic candidate yet. So it's so far
right,
out.
Right, I know. The hypothetical races, everybody's great in hypothetical.
And you know what's a really good indicator, though, right now, is 71%, almost highest on record, of people feeling good about the economy. Mm. That's a better sign of what's going to happen in 2020.
Anecdotally, though, and I talk to a lot of people, thousands of people who listen to this show, I get the emails, I read each one of them, and I see other people's reporting. There's a sense, obviously, a good sense about the economy. People are finally comfortable about their jobs, and there are more jobs than there are people looking to find jobs. So that's great. Wages are rising. But there is a bit of a disconnect between the 70-some-odd percent that are very happy and feeling good about the economy and the president's approval rating. What is the RNC's explanation for that? Because I believe he's his own worst enemy in a lot of ways. He steps on his own message more often than not. The worst thing he has going for him is his overuse of Twitter. I don't think he should stop using Twitter. I think he uses it very effectively. It just sometimes needs an internal governor. But the best thing he has going for him is just how crazy the Democrats are. But in an economy booming like it is, he should be in the 50% an approval rating. He's never been there.
Well, some polls actually he is at up to 50, and it's been trickling up actually his approval rating over the past few months. There's never going to be a fully accurate picture of the president's numbers, because when you can't even be a 16-year-old kid that goes to the March for Life and wears your MAGA hat without them wanting to ruin your life, destroy your reputation. Why would you tell a stranger, oh, yeah, I support the president, I wear a MAGA group? Why would you tell a stranger that when the media has such disdain for average Americans and Democrats? They look down on you and you're all of a sudden the worst person in the world if you support a president who is a duly elected president. So I think there's always going to be...
silent group that just aren't going to say anything?
Absolutely. And, you know, I disagree with you. I think he's actually his best messenger.
I think he's also his best messenger, but I think if he doesn't,
and that's why I think you see his, you know, where his approval numbers are really high is within the Republican Party. Mm. Because they're happy that a president is actually sticking up for the base.
I love seeing somebody fighting back instead of apologizing.
And not letting the media and the Democrats define him. I mean, that's what we saw with John McCain and Mitt Romney, and they go in front of the cameras and they want the adulation after they destroyed them when they ran for president and called them a racist, said all these other things. Oh, they didn't push back. Well, now you have a president that does push back, doesn't let them define him because he's fighting for the country and they're never going to stop. They're never going to let up. So I think a lot of people actually appreciate the combativeness and not letting the Democrats and the media speak for the entire
I think CNN will go out of business before they actually start practicing journalism again.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you about the disdain from the media, because I've talked to a lot of people who study the media. And while it's certainly the vast majority of the American people view the media as biased as it is, they still have an influence. The middle of the country, the people that you have to actually sway, the people who don't pay attention to politics and aren't committed to one side or the other, the persuadables, are casual news observers to a large percentage. They might just catch, you know, the nightly news every once in a while. They can still have, the media can still have a massive impact. The RNC has a lot of money. The Trump campaign has a lot of money. Is there a plan to counteract that aside from going on cable news and getting into arguments with these people, which you do all the time? But is there, there has to be almost an education. People don't understand the conclusions of the Mueller report because the media has muddied those waters again, for example.
I think they understand that there is no there.
But they're still beating that drum. And you're
and
not competing
not,
for
the, I mean, look at
the vast majority. You're competing for 3% in the middle.
Yeah, I understand the point, but look at the ratings.
Oh, I know.
They let down their own base.
Yes.
By selling them. I mean, they said, we have the evidence. Adam Schiff was on TV every day for 2 years saying there is collusion. And when you don't actually have the goods and it falls apart, you're letting down your own most passionate voters.
Well, CNN lost a third of their audience.
Yeah.
And Maddow lost a huge chunk.
Look, they have no credibility left. They've absolutely ruined their standing. I mean, the 2016 coverage was so bad, but they've doubled down.
They've learned nothing.
They've learned nothing. They've never for once looked in the mirror and said, wait a minute, what did we miss here? How did we get this so wrong? They immediately went to, oh, no, we didn't stop the fake news. And then when that was turned around its head, because the president correctly pointed out, actually, you're the worst actors on that. You're the fake news. They said, oh, it was Russia. And we lived under that conspiracy, insane excuse for the 2016 election.
Still do if you're watching CNN.
So, I mean, who believes them? Who believes them? And we have a great strategy. We have a great media relations team, and we're constantly planting stories, pushing back on negative stories. We're constantly working on the narrative.
Who in the Democratic field has kind of
a lost cause at CNN.
I know you guys prepare. You got a clown car full of people on the other side, almost 24. And some of them, you don't have to really prepare for Hickenlooper. I'm sorry, John Hickenlooper, but it's just not your year. But obviously, Pete Buttigieg has to be a surprise. Who is the biggest surprise in the Democratic field? Not just from how they're doing it in the field so far, is from somebody who's got to prepare for any eventuality. And you're looking like, who's this guy? He's a mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Is Mayor Pete the biggest shock so far? Not that it's over.
That's kind of an interesting thing that I'm just thinking about. It kind of relates to your last question, because the media kind of created this guy.
Well, they have flavor of the month for sure.
Yeah, and it was all based on a fake fight with the vice president that was not like Mike Pence. The vice president doesn't have a problem with him whatsoever.
Right.
It's completely a political stunt. And I guess it worked because he's, up in third place, I guess, in the polls. But it doesn't really matter because they're all pushing the same radical, crazy policies led by Bernie Sanders. He said his mission after 2016 was to transform the Democratic Party and then also this country. Well, I don't think we're not going to let that happen for one of the country, but he was successful in transforming the Democratic Party because they all are adopting radical
And he's kneecapped himself. They don't need him anymore because they get the same thing from younger people.
His problem, he came out a little bit too early for letting terrorists vote in prison. You know, he could have waited on that a little. It's kind of hurt him a bit. But no, they're every single one of them is adopting these crazy big government high taxes. You know, 70% is the floor for how high they want to raise taxes.
It has to be a benefit for you guys because no matter who the nominee is, the issues are all the same. You don't have to prepare if this person is the nominee, we've got to be ready for this. And they're all the same.
You're already on record pretty much for socialized medicine. They're all on record for this crazy Green New Deal. All on record for taxpayer-funded abortions. I mean, open borders. Yeah, free all this stuff. It's radical. And the American people aren't stupid. They're smart. They know there's no such thing as a free lunch. This isn't free college. We're going to pay for it. And Bernie Sanders, at least to his credit, is very honest. Oh, the American people will be delighted about paying more in taxes. He's wrong about that, but he's right under his plan. You're going to be paying more.
Well, you had Joe Biden the other day saying the first thing he would do is repeal the president's tax plan, which is essentially promising a tax increase to everybody. The last time a former vice president running against an incumbent president promised to raise taxes was 1984 with Walter Mondale. Unambiguously, I'm going to raise your taxes. And I think that didn't go too well for Fritz in that case. But is there a risk of underestimating Joe Biden? He's been in politics for 50 years. He knows how to win in Delaware. He hasn't done so well in national races when he's at the top of the ticket. But he is a very experienced, savvy politician who knows how the machine works. It's really easy to dismiss him as creepy, sniffy, gropey Uncle Joe because he is all those things.
I just saw on Twitter that they're censoring the sniffing as his searches. They like to do that. They like to cover for their Democrat friends and, you know, the autofill search results. But anyway. But I think most people do.
Is there a risk of underestimating him? I mean, he is goofy. He's gaff machine. But he's also got so much goodwill built up from being kind of goofy. It's Joe being Joe, that so much of it has been forgiven. He's done things in this race that would ruin mortals.
Right. Well, you're talking about the general election, which I think is what his campaign was trying. That was their strategy. But his problem is, it's not the general election yet. He's got to get through a lot of far left people who are already dragging him to the left. And look at the news today. He's getting fire from all sides about his comments he made about working with the segregationists.
Yes.
I mean, that shows you how old.
Saying nice things.
I mean, and that hurts him as well. Look, he's talking about working with segregationists. In his own, this wasn't about crossing the aisle. Right. This is in the Democratic Party, by the way.
Well, that's where they mostly lived.
He's been, exactly. But he's been in Washington for a half a century. What has he ever accomplished? That hurts him too. I mean,
well, the things he's accomplished, he has to now run away from. He used to say, exactly. I wrote the crime bill. Now he says, I apologize for the crime
exactly.
bill.
Exactly. So it's a complete mess. I mean, it's a very big, I think, uphill battle for him, actually. I mean, he's polling in the highest, but he doesn't have that big of a lead. And he doesn't have enthusiasm.
No. He doesn't have any energy.
They only say he has no energy. I mean, I almost went to sleep. It was insane. They set up 94 seats. That's all in the lobby of that theater. The theater, they could have gone inside and they sit 650 people. They couldn't fill it.
No.
So they had 94 seats. There's no enthusiasm for him. I guess people, you know, it's so early and we're going to see in the debates next week.
That's going to be fun.
Are you going to be there? I'm not going to be there, but I will be watching.
let's shift focus because in addition, the White House race is obviously the most important, but right below it is the fight to retake the House. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Nothing gave me more pleasure than in 2011 to be able to say, or 2013, be able to say, I guess it was 2011, former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. But the Democrats have a big margin in the House right now. But those victories came in red districts, or at least red-ish districts.
Yeah, except for the ballot harvesting.
They were certainly favorable to Republicans.
Right, yeah, some of those were red.
What are the prospects of retaking the House?
I think they're good. I mean, look, they won a majority with these moderate districts, but they're not legislating on a moderate basis. If they were, the crisis on the border would be fixed by now. I mean, it's absolutely a disgrace. They're doing nothing in the House to do that. And there are issues that they could work with the president. The president has said over and over again, we want to work on infrastructure. We want to do this. They're prioritizing their radical base. Just today, Nancy Pelosi refused to condemn Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's latest absurd comments.
She justified comparing it.
She tripled down on, like, it's so insane. And Nancy Pelosi doesn't have the courage. She couldn't condemn Ilhan Omar and her anti-Semitism. That was a disgrace as well. That meaningless resolution that didn't condemn. They are being led by the impeachment frenzy, which is so insane that Nancy Pelosi knows the country doesn't want. And that's why she's stalling and she's trying to buy time. And she knows she'll lose her speakership if that's the path they go down, because it's really difficult to impeach a president without a crime whatsoever. And then she's talking behind closed doors, well, we'll imprison him.
Yeah.
So, I'm just as crazy as you all are. Like, don't worry. I think there's a very good chance we can take back the House because they have not legislated moderately. They are listening to the loudest small minority in their party, which we see it in the 2020 race as well.
Who's the head of the Democratic Party right now?
I would say it's Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. That is the wing that's the loudest. That's the wing that, I mean, they're going forward with reparations in the House. Is that a moderate agenda that's going to keep their majority?
Sheila Jackson Lee, noted moderate. Yeah.
So absolutely. And we're putting a lot of resources into that. And we can just show, look, at the end of the day, there's only one party. There's only one president that's actually working to address problems that Americans care about. And the Democrats are AWOL. They're not there.
As important as the House is maintaining the Senate, especially in terms of the Supreme Court, that was a huge help to Donald Trump in 2016 and a hindrance to Hillary Clinton. I think a lot of people didn't want her appointing the next Supreme Court justice. It's a tight race in the Senate. The 2018 election was actually a more favorable map for Republicans. There are more Republicans up this time than there were in 2018, because 6-year cycles. Are there any races we should be watching? Are the Republicans going to beat Doug Jones in where you should not have a Democratic senator in Alabama, for example?
Yeah, that's a great pickup opportunity. We definitely are looking to take that back. And I think there's a lot of states that are open, and there are more Republicans up, but they're also running in very strong. A lot of
they're
those
safer.
States are very red Trump states that he won by large margins. So we're actually looking pretty good right now as far as the map goes. We have a pickup opportunity first and foremost in Alabama. We also have a pickup opportunity in Michigan.
John Jones is running again there.
Right. We don't take stances on primaries, but I think we're going to have a lot of good opportunities in those states in particular. And Democrats have what their problem is. Chuck Schumer has been terrible at recruiting candidates. Stacey Abrams, I guess she's too busy off running the state of Georgia.
Run. Yeah, she's secret shadow governor.
Right. Couldn't recruit her. She was supposed to be, the star to run in Georgia for Senate. Couldn't convince her to do it. He's had a terrible time. No one's interested in the Democrat side. So they have an uphill battle, actually. And I think our party, we're looking very good in the Senate.
Martha McSally in Arizona lost, but then was appointed.
Yeah.
She's got to come up and actually win the seat this time. What is your assessment of that race? She had been rejected, I think, twice statewide so far.
Well, it was a very close race.
It was.
And Senator Sinema ran as a moderate, very.
She's actually voted with Republicans, surprisingly, a lot.
Right. So absolutely, I think Martha McSally will do a great job. She is a good candidate. I mean,
she's got a great biography. I don't know how great of a candidate
she can be a great. She's already in the Senate doing a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. So I think we have a very good shot at that. And also, Mr. Kelly running? He's for gun control.
Yes.
I mean, he's running. He's not a moderate.
He's a biography candidate, essentially.
Yeah, but I mean, that's his main issue. And that's not going to be, he's not going to be running a moderate race.
No.
So
talking about issues internally when you guys, I don't want you to give away any trade secrets or anything, but there's a difference between people caring about something and it being an issue that moves their vote. What do you see as far as from the voting public, the issues that they care about the most, and which, like, maybe the one or two issues you're finding that actually move votes?
Definitely the economy, first and foremost, and immigration is one we constantly see. It always polls very highly as an issue that people care about. And I think the media has always gotten that wrong. They assume that it's a bad issue for Republicans. I think the president has proved that it's actually a winning issue because it's been one of his central issues from the beginning, and he's still working to address it because people want to be a nation of laws and a nation of borders.
Crazy idea.
Right? I mean, who would have ever thought? And it's a problem that
at least Democrats have discovered
parties,
federalism. Hey, leave the cities alone.
And it's a problem that's persisted for decades that both parties have failed to address.
Right.
That's a huge issue. Of course, abortion and pro-life issues are a huge issue for people that
care about. But I think that's baked into the cake. If you're voting on abortion, you're voting that way no matter what. But the immigration issue, I think, is an ever-growing issue. And the more the numbers get across the border and hear about them, I think that does have a chance of winning more converts.
And And look, the president won, back to the economy, the president won a lot of these millions of people who voted for Barack Obama in 2012. And are they going to want to all of a sudden change course to the high tax? Oh, here's 70% tax rates, 90% tax rates. No. I mean, I just heard a great quote from a Trump supporter who was at the rally in one of the news write-ups. He said, you know, I voted for Obama and I lost my job. I lost two different jobs under Obama. Why do I support Trump? I haven't lost my job once. But it's as simple as that.
Yeah, it is.
Because why would you want to change course when the economy is actually growing again? We're investing in this country. We're no longer the highest tax place on earth. We're a good place to do business. And what does that mean? That means more competition. More. If there's a million more job openings than there are unemployed people in this country right now, that means more freedom to leave the job you have right now and find a better one.
And why would you switch to somebody who tells you that the economy is actually bad? I'll make it the way it was when it was bad.
And people who have failed to get the job done, especially Joe Biden.
Liz Harrington, where can people find out more about everything that the RNC is doing?
GOP.com, at GOP on Twitter. I'm at Liz RNC.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks for coming in. Thanks
for
giving us an update.
Me.
Hopefully we can check in with you throughout this race because it seems like it's quite a ways off.
God. Hey, we're just getting started.
It's a marathon, not a sprint. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Don't forget to subscribe. Have a great weekend and be back here on Monday.
Hey, ma'am, I'm sorry. If you disagree with me, that's fine. That's my view.